every year in this congregation, as many of you know, we have this goofy, lovely, uproarious auction. And one of the items that's put up in the auction most years is the chance to choose a sermon topic. And the one stipulation for this process reads something like, within the boundaries of reasonably good taste, you are invited to help Reverend Nancy choose a sermon topic. And each year, the auction winners have far exceeded that stipulation, taking us into reflection on things that I could never have thought up alone. And I tell you, this year's auction sermon winner, Peg Green, who, by the way, is the artist who made this and who helped create the big, colorful thing that's often back here. Peg, when she came in to tell me the sermon idea she had for this year, was grinning from ear to ear, especially when she told me the title, which you see before you now. The Sock Monkey Sermon, she said, should be inspired by the other item that I always put up for auction at the church auction. Namely, I make homemade sock monkeys. It's a goofy, fun thing I do. One year in seminary, I made 67 of them, all personalized for all my friends. Like, my most flamingly gay friend got a Chippendale monkey. And the woman who reminded me of my grandma in a good way got a Rose Gardener monkey. And everybody received that same gift because it's what I had to give and was broke that year. I've had to pare it down now. I only make two a year, and they're usually for the church auction. And I have promised that one of these years I'm going to figure out how to make a socktopus, which I have not yet created, which would be an eight-legged sock monkey. So you have that to look forward to. In any case, what Peg saw and responded to at the auction was the fact that these silly sock monkeys, nothing more than a pair of socks and some thread, inspired more joy than seemed even reasonable. I wish I had invited everyone who's bought them over the years to bring them and wave them. That would have been brilliant. There's one. Nice. Good. The way our faces light up when we duke it out for who's going to take home that goofy prize is a remarkable thing, maybe even holy, and there's got to be something behind that. What is it about our community and this goofy little thing that it becomes such a source of delight for us? Now, I promise you, and I promise Peg, that I am going to get there. I'm going to talk about why those sock monkeys have significance, but true to my usual form, I'm going to take a rather circuitous route through theology, philosophy, and various personal reflections to reach that. So stay with me. Put the sock monkeys in the back of your head for just a minute, and I'll tell you two other stories that I believe have some bearing on the situation. The first story took place last spring at our District Unitarian Universalist Minister's Retreat. All the UU ministers from Philly south to the Rappahannock, we get together a couple of times a year for worship and to think deep thoughts and things like that. And last year, during the closing worship service of the retreat, the worship leader preached a rousing sermon about embodiment, how we should be in our bodies and we should feel our faith and not just think about it. And then before she sat down, she announced that music would shortly begin to play, and that all of us, as spiritual leaders, as those who guide others down paths of faithful living, should be leaders in this too. And as the music played, she said, we should move. As the Spirit called us, we should move. However we saw fit, allowing the notes to carry themselves through us, our hearts to be transported to some realm above the rational, our bodies to give voice to the wisdom of our souls. And one by one, my precious colleagues did just that. They moved an arm in a graceful arc over their heads. They bowed to the earth and they thanked God for the ground from which we spring and to which we must all eventually return. They flipped and floated and jittered and jived. And do you know what your minister did? As all this was going on, do you know what your spiritual leader was able to muster? I stood up because it felt like I should. And I put my hands in my pockets and I did the classic white man dancing lower lip biting thing. And I moved one foot back and forth. That was all I could do, for apparently my spirit was not yet able to say, dance. That's all you got out of me. Second story. Also from my life, if only because it's easier to tattle on myself than to tattle on all of you. This last Tuesday, a gathering of us went down to the Washington, D.C. offices of GE Capital to protest that company's persistent refusal to be a part of the solution of the foreclosure crisis in Prince William County. GE Capital was the worst lender in this county, catering to minority borrowers and giving their brokers enormous kickbacks for selling low-income families bad loans. Our community organizing group, Voice, has been asking them to take responsibility for almost a year now, and since they haven't chosen to do so, we took the Washington Post and several other press outlets down with us to their corporate offices to deliver a message that enough is enough and responsibility is important. Now, as many of you know, in our community organizing group, I have taken on a role as, well, the closer. People come up and they articulate our points and they pray and they speak the truth of justice making, and then at the end, it is my job to stand up and rile everybody up and get them chanting things and ready to march in the streets. They do not call me the bulldog from Bull Run for nothing. And Tuesday was no exception. I stood up and I flat laid it down. I shook my fists and I pointed to the heavens and I said something like, GE Capital, you have turned our neighborhoods into a valley of dry bones, and the day will come when those bones shall rise up. And I demanded the firing of GE Capital's CEO, Jeff Immelt, et cetera, et cetera. And before you know it, the entire crowd was chanting, you're fired, you're fired, you're fired, over and over again. We all had pink slips, and the bulldog, she got hold, and she did not let go. And immediately after it was over, we gathered at a local church to go over the action and to talk about how it went. People were energized and excited. Mike Freeland said it was his best lunch hour ever. Folks were talking and offering feedback, and somewhere in the middle of it, our lead organizer, Martin Tremble, looked over at me, where I was standing in the side of the room trying to hide behind the coat rack. And he said, Reverend Nancy, do you have something to say? You look pensive. And I played it off with a joke, like, no, I'm just being quiet for a change, ha ha. But the truth I could not say in that moment is that I was hiding next to the coat rack looking pensive and saying nothing because I was ashamed. I was feeling vulnerable and fearful and like I'd let too much of myself show, and so I wanted to hide, because even in the face of real live justice making, all of that emotion, all of that messy, mucky, embodied emotion still makes me uncomfortable. And hiding behind the coat rack seemed like my best available option. These two stories for me illustrate the ways in which, in my one little life, I have so thoroughly absorbed the tenets and theologies and philosophies I don't even believe in but can't help live out. There's a theology and a philosophy about the body, about emotion, the icky and complicated and often joyful stuff of human life. Things like laughter or anger or honest suffering or foolishness. There's a tendency to be afraid of these things that has soaked into my bones from a dominant Western culture that is all wrapped around the history of the Christian church. What is it that keeps any of us from letting go, from dancing or shouting or laughing or singing? What is it that edits our emotions, our bodily movements, our very selves, turning us from wildly expressive creatures to tidy, reasonable, self-contained beings who dance with our hands shoved down in our pockets and feel shame at the expression of righteous anger? Religion, let's be honest, has long been a part of the problem. The separation of the body and the soul, the idea that the true self is not this skin sack we're in, but somehow above it, purer than human emotion, has pervaded the Christian church since at least the early church fathers. Early Christian theologian Plotinus, for instance, believed that the soul had made a serious downgrade when it dropped down from heaven and descended from that perfect immaterial world and plopped into this dirty, goofy, complicated place. To those early church fathers, it's only when we get rid of these bodies with their weird, complicated motions and emotions that we can get back in touch with the higher, immaterial, spiritual world of God. Of course, the pagans among us will remind me that all of this traces back to certain threads of Greek philosophy, like Platonism, and it isn't as much originally Christian as it is originally Greek and quite pagan, but still, Western Christendom has taken hold of the separation of body and soul, the cleaving of the holy from the experiences of the body in remarkable ways. Turns out that even against my will, that way of thinking, of being awkward with anything too embodied, too emotional, too real, it has tricked its way into my soul. The body is strange and emotions are vulnerable, so dancing in public is scary and being angry in front of people is evidence of a not fully controlled character. That's a message that plays in a loop in my head. And whether I want it to or not, it continues to do so. The other difficult truth is that this message does not only play in my head. Listen to some Unitarian Universalists and most mainline Protestants trying to clap along to music. And you will see that this loop plays in most of our heads too. That's why I wanted to hide in the coat rack, because I have been taught by generations of my forebears to be suspicious of anything too human, and to aspire to other less complicated things like purity and self-control. But purity and self-control only take you so far in the life of the spirit. Western Christendom in its own way gets that too, if only partially. That's the real reason why festivals exist. I saw a picture in the Post a few weeks ago of the Episcopalian rectors at the Washington National Cathedral. And I tell you, like, I wear a fancy outfit, but they wear a really fancy outfit with just robes and tabs and fancy hats and all of this fabulous stuff. And anyway, there they were, the rectors of the National Cathedral, decked out in their regalia, but this time wearing paper hats and falling over themselves while being a part of a relay race where they carried these little tiny skillets and flipped pancakes whilst running. I think it was their Fat Tuesday celebration at the Episcopal Cathedral at the beginning of Mardi Gras, a day when even the rector gets to act goofy and walk along trying to flip a pancake. Isn't that wonderful? And in New Orleans on the same day, they were catching beads and dancing to jazz trombones and getting drunk and being foolish and cutting loose. Traditions of festival time within Christendom have always been the bright few occasions in which self-controlled philosophies take a backseat and basic humanity gets put on display. Nothing has ever been able to quash those traditions entirely. And some argue that it is exactly these kinds of experiences that can still make religion meaningful, even as it crumbles all around us in this postmodern world. In her book, Dancing in the Streets, Barbara Ehrenreich argues that American religion, and most of our culture in general, has too long overlooked the simple necessity of communal joy. She's not talking about communal optimism. See, I am convinced that relentless optimism is its own kind of oppression, and I am not advocating for that either. She's talking about communal joy, dancing in the face of warfare, singing into the darkness of oppression, lifting one another off the ground by the grace that moves in community. Communal joy, she says, is really a whole lot of the point of why people get together. We don't get together to think about joy or reason our way out of our emotions, but to feel joy over and over again in ways we could not do without one another. There is something unsafe, something risky, something beautiful and untidy, yet honest, about the lived experience of joy shared in a community. And there are traditions around the world that have always had the very risky uncertainty of humor and shared delight as one of the holiest things of all. Again, there are threads of this insight in the history of the Christian church, not least of which is the role of the jester in the medieval court. The jester existed like the Navajo trickster to turn the world on its head, to make the orderly universe disorderly again, to bring laughter where there would otherwise be plodding piousness. But once again, as with the constrained, time-limited festivals like Mardi Gras, the jester was responsible for being goofy so that the rest of the court didn't have to be. The fool carried the foolishness of the court, ghettoizing the experience of humor so that the intentionally goofy person could be the only one holding that load. It still wasn't safe or appropriate for the good people to be foolish. Not burdened by the moody constraints of Greek philosophy, the religious traditions of Native Americans touch deeply on the lived experience of communal joy. Many religious and communal practices exist in Native American traditions in order to reach a heightened state of emotion, not to contain such a state or get it under control. Peg reminded me that Hopi Kachina dolls are these artistic representations of the spirits at play or the spirits at mischief. They're forces that come and mess with all of the order we pretend we have control over. They get us just off balance enough to admit we never did have control in the first place. And the truth is that we ought to admit such things. We ought to let honest emotion be free among us. We ought to allow for the expression of our souls to dance and drum and feel righteous anger and weep in public. When those seemingly icky, non-tidy emotions are real, we ought to not hide them under our shame and our generations of philosophies. We ought to live them, because in this messy living there is holiness. In this way, Sunday morning is the one time reserved above all others in our culture for community and connection and for trying to tell the truth. We gather to tell the whole truth, not half-truths or persistent falsehoods, like the idea that our propriety is more important than our joy, or our strategies for success are more important than loving one another. If it is to long survive the struggles and pains of this world, one central role in the life of religious community must be an ever-evolving experience of joy. And here, I think, is where the sock monkeys come in. You see, I told you I would get there. When the minister of this congregation spends her time making silly sock monkeys and offering them up to the community, the minister of this congregation is being publicly goofy. And we delight in it. The veil that separates the proper piety of the religious leader lifts for a time, and we get to be foolish and playful and happy together. It is one of our ways of breaking down the barriers between the sacred and the mundane. Why shouldn't ministers make socktopuses? And why shouldn't congregations act silly? And why shouldn't Episcopalian rectors run down the street flipping pancakes and good waspy Protestants find themselves dancing, not with awkward steps, but with full-bodied delight? If there is one thing that separates Brew from most of the surrounding religious culture, and even from most of Unitarian Universalism, it is that at our best we are not afraid to be goofy. You all are actually better at this than I am. Some of you are true champions of the art form. And this is a gift we give one another. Anytime the veil of separation lifts, anytime we laugh without holding back, anytime we dance like no one's watching, anytime we shout over the rooftops so loud we lose our voices, we let go of that which separates our lives from God's holiness. And every time we do that, we are changed, and we are more honest, and we are more real. As people of faith, As Unitarian Universalists, we are called to speak the truth of life just as it is, for all of its complexity and its pain and its beauty. For if we cannot experience the full spectrum of life here in this safe and silly place, where can we do it? So let there be joy in the sanctuary. Let there be silliness. Let there be sock monkeys.